Okay, let's wrap this up quickly. Just a couple more little themes on mystification in my notes. First, on the issue of functionalist thinking. So just to remind you, functionalist thinking has the form of observing some phenomenon, such as mystification, and asking why do people hold these beliefs? Why does mystification occur? And the answer is because it's functional for reproducing capitalism, because it's good for the capitalist class, or it's functional for reproducing capitalism. Why does the state do what it does? Because it's good for capitalism. Why is ideology the way it is? Because it's good for capitalism. Why is the mystification dimension of ideology the way it is? Because it's good for capitalism. There's a strong tendency in Marxist discussions to adopt highly functionalist ways of understanding the distortions. Capitalism is somehow seen as secreting precisely those distortions that are optimal for capitalism. Commodity and capital fetishism are not merely masks of realities, but mystifications that optimally deflect workers' consciousness from challenges to the capitalist order. Now, you can see that it's not logically the case. It could be the case that market fetishism is spontaneously produced by capitalism. That is the level of appearances that we live our lives in capitalism. But that it could be very suboptimal. You know, it could cause all sorts of problems. It could lead capitalist states to make huge mistakes that destabilize capitalism because they are sucked into this mystification just like everybody else. So mystifications that obscure reality need not intrinsically also reproduce the reality which they obscure. They could be deleterious to the reality which they obscure. So it requires additional arguments to say not only does mystification obscure reality, that we can establish, but also that it's beneficial for the reality it so obscures, beneficial for either the class or the stability of the system or some other, quote, beneficial. Talking about the beneficial effects of something is always, that's sort of in accord with its functionalist thinking. If you ask the question, what is the role of mystification? If you use that expression, role, what is the role of mystification? That's a functionalist language. Roles are part of systems in which the role is to stabilize the system. That's part of this base superstructure way of thinking about ideology. The ideology serves the role of stabilizing. So it doesn't just obscure the reality, it obscures it in such a way as to stabilize it. Now, I'm generally critical but not dismissive of functional explanations. I do think there's a role for them in certain ways, but I think they're often sloppy. That they are sloppy because they don't really specify the mechanisms properly by which that functional correspondence occurs. There are two points I'd like to emphasize specifically about the problems of functionalist reasoning with respect to the problem of mystification. Two things that I think just should continually keep in mind. First, I've already just alluded to, mystification distorts the perceptions and understandings of the bourgeoisie as well as the proletariat, to state it in its polarized form. Ideology as mystification prevents the capitalist class and the state from understanding adequately the workings of capitalist society, and thus it impedes their own rationality. Capitalists tend to have very narrow particularistic views in their own consciousness. They think that what's ever good for them is good for everybody. And that's a completely false view of the interests of the capitalist class as a whole. It's not true that whatever is best for finance is best for the stability of capitalism. What's best for finance is best for finance. It's not best for capitalism as a whole. Distorted understandings of how capitalism works may indeed be more devastating to subordinate groups. You know, this may have worse consequences for the exploited than the exploiter to have misunderstandings for the conditions of their own exploitation. It may disable struggles from below more than it disables management from above, but it disables both. It can cause problems for both. And there are circumstances in which states and capitalist classes act in such pig-headed and distorted and mystified ways, or they act on the basis of such distorted views about how the world works, that they engage in very self-destructive actions. And that would not be the case if mystifications were systematically produced so as to stabilize capitalism. So the fact that mystification does stabilize capitalism is not the issue. It often does. It often leads to distortions of reality that helps to protect the system. But that should be viewed as not an intrinsic property of mystification, but as an accomplishment. There's ways in which that happens. And that brings me to the second point. The thesis of automatic functionality, of seamless functionality, obscures, I think, itself. It deflects analysis away from the problem of what I would call the institutional obstacles to demystification. It's a kind of shift of the question. Rather than asking how does mystification serve the interests of the capitalist class, there's an alternative way of asking the question, which is, what are the institutional barriers to demystification? So rather than asking the question in the form, what is it in people's daily practices in life which distorts their cognitive maps of the society, rather than ask that question, rather than only ask that question, we also need to ask the question, what are the obstacles or mechanisms or processes which block the process of demystification, which obstruct challenges to demystification? Especially given that many of the elements of knowledge of these relations exist. You know, discourse is, in a sense, organizing as systematically as I can an inventory of the knowledge of demystification. Why is it that most people continue to accept the mystifications generated by everyday life when there is available knowledge that would debunk these mystifications? Why is market fetishism so pervasive, given that the critique of market fetishism has already been generated? It's not as if we don't understand what's wrong with it. Yeah?
I was going to say, is this sort of the same sleight of hand that is used to make the argument about negative selectivity? Like the way in which it's not a purely functionalist argument, but by talking about sort of the biases that obstruct demystification?
Well, yes, so the biases that obstruct demystification would be one way, one aspect of the problem. What are the obstacles to demystification? Sure. And this directs us to the next item on the list, ideological apparatuses. The answer to that question, how do we understand the obstacles to demystification, takes us directly to the problem of what is sometimes called ideological apparatuses. It's what it used to be called. That's not such a common discussion term anymore. These are the institutions which systematically codify, defend, and propagate ideologies and block challenges. When Marx says that the ruling class not only controls the means of physical production, but also the means of ideological production, this is what he's referring to, the control over institutions which elaborate ideologies, which develop and propagate those ideologies. This defines a basic process by which demystification is thwarted. So just as churches in the 16th century were the ideological apparatuses which blocked the demystification of ideologies of nature, they controlled the means of production of disseminated ideas, of the explicit discursive representation of the world. That was controlled by the church. The primary mass media, so to speak, of the time was controlled by religious institutions. The struggle against religion, then, was the key to opening up the space for scientific demystification of ideologies of nature. The scientific demystification of ideologies of nature would have proceeded way more rapidly if churches hadn't attempted to block it, which they successfully did for a short time, but couldn't withstand the scientific revolution, in part because of the connection between the scientific revolution and the political economic changes that were occurring at the same time with capitalism and its associated opening of all sorts of other competitive and open spaces. So one, you know, there's a complicated connection between the emergence of markets and capitalism on the one hand and the scientific revolution on the other. This is, histories of science talk about this all the time. But it was the fact that there was some kind of correspondence between those that made it possible to defeat the religious obstructionism, but which continues to the present time. You know, anti-scientific religious obstruction of demystification of nature continues right now, but in a very feeble way, except in the US, where it's not so feeble. Ideological struggle, then, I think, should be thought of especially as struggle over the apparatuses, the ideological machinery that propagates discursively and symbolically ideas and beliefs which reinforce the mystifications or block the demystifications. So it remains the case, just as with the sun setting, that market fetishism, the belief that these are really powerful forces that constrain what we can do and that they have this kind of empowered aspect, that people would experience that. It's not that belief is created by propaganda. The propaganda consolidates those beliefs and gives them stronger cognitive status and blocks the demystification. The way to get around then the functionalist view is to see it as contingent rather than automatic, the extent to which ideological apparatuses are able to deploy power to block efforts at demystification. And it's an accomplishment then when the ideologies all work nicely to reinforce and stabilize a system rather than something that's spontaneously generated by the mere workings of the system. In that way, the chapters on commodity fetishism in Marx are a little bit misleading if taken just on their own terms, because those chapters make it seem that the stabilizing effects, subjective effects of the operation of capitalism are just spontaneously produced by capitalist relations, rather than really seeing this more complicated process by which that stabilizing fact only occurs by virtue of the blockage of a demystifying process. Yeah?
It seems like a lot of this is very like social psychology like.
Right, absolutely.
Is there anything, like any interesting contribution from psychology that, you know, sticks within a Marxist framework that talks about this from a more psychological?
Yeah, so the fourth lecture in this series on the micro foundations of ideology is precisely about the psychological processes that interface with these and give, so things like wishful thinking, cognitive dissonance, adaptive preference formation. There's a whole series of psychological mechanisms which come into play in conjunction with these social processes that enable these beliefs to become anchored in terms of the way psychological processes work. And disrupted also by those processes. Yeah, so that's what the fourth lecture is on. Yeah?
Can you like just sort of specify like what are the institutions that produce ideologies?
So the media, of course, are a big one. Education. Religion continues to play some role. And remember, I'm speaking not just about institutions that produce ideology in general, but institutions that block demystification. So we're focusing specifically on that aspect of it. But still, the media is involved in various ways. So the biases, the way in which the media portrays economic crisis and focuses on the power of the market would be an example of the media reinforcing one particular set of ideas. When media have pundits talking back and forth, who do they pick? Well, they pick people who fall within the spectrum of affirmations about the centrality and importance of capitalism and the necessity of capitalism for providing jobs and well-being for people, but differ in their particular views about what the failures and solutions are to the existing problems within capitalism. So you never get on any of these discussions people who are critical of capitalism as such. Even the kind of left reformist critics of capitalism who say, yes, capitalism between consenting adults might be all right as part of our economic system, but it shouldn't dominate it, right? So that's still gives some positive view of capitalism, but just, so those are never included in the media discussion. That silence means that there's no attempt at demystification of the core idea that capitalism has to be at the center of any solution, not merely because of the power relations which block more radical alternatives, but because there are no more radical alternatives. So media is important, education for sure. But what I would like to emphasize is that these apparatuses are not seamless. So educational apparatuses in particular have lots of cracks in them. Many, you know, in some places more than others. In Texas, less. You know, in Texas, the curriculum in high schools is way more ideologically coherent as a defense of the existing social order. The new Texas history standards, Thomas Jefferson was dropped, apparently, as an important contributor because he was considered too liberal on certain grounds. It's a little hard to believe, but I mean, not that he's not mentioned as the second president of the United States and as the author of the Declaration of Independence, but he's not included as one of the important figures whose ideas are to be studied. I believe that's right. I think it was Thomas Jefferson.
I think that's true. It was somebody who, like, absurdly important, like
right.
Jefferson or a Franklin, right? That it
right.
would be, and
right.
it would be laughed at by history department.
Right. Right. So some places have much more self-conscious and single-minded effort to maintain very strong ideological dominance within the ideological apparatuses to not allow any dissenting views that might have kernels of demystification. And other ideological apparatuses are much looser. They understand that that deviation isn't so dangerous, have more radical, you know, more critical voices inside of the ideological apparatus itself. But the degree to which ideological apparatuses effectively function to shore up the dominant ideology and to exclude demystifying practices, that extent should be viewed as variable, and it's a site of conflict as opposed to a functional system that's automatically produced in such a way as to function as a closed system. One just very final little almost footnote. Jerry Cohen, who will be reading extensively in the last couple of weeks of the semester, he argues that in the terms of his discussion, that fetishism disappears in capital C communism, that is, in a society without classes, and that more generally communism is an unmystified social world. All relations become immediately transparent. There's no gap between the experience of reality and the knowledge of reality. He even goes so far as to say social science disappears. You don't need science for an object that is transparent. You only need science to reveal things that are hidden, right? I don't think that makes sense in my view. I think he's just wrong. I mean, I think he's wrong, first of all, because class antagonisms have either disappeared or been heavily muted in a post-capitalist egalitarian society, it doesn't mean that all antagonisms have, so there's still plenty of conflicts around of all sorts that in which actors will have stakes in hiding what they're doing. So there'll be all sorts of ways in which things are not always what they seem. There'll still be distorted perceptions, just as distorted perceptions exist in nature. Prisoners' dilemmas, collective action failures, free riding will still be a problem. And free riding, as we know, produces distortions. This idea that each person pursuing their rational interest produces an outcome which is irrational even for them, that's not transparent. That's not something immediately on the surface. It requires analysis. I think what would be different in a democratic egalitarian society would be the weakness of the social forces committed to blocking demystification. So it's the equivalent of getting rid of the church with respect to the ideologies of nature. There's still plenty of distortions of nature that our lived experience and direct observation do not tell us what's really going on. And therefore, it requires real analysis, research to understand what the real processes are. It's just that the mobilized forces to block demystification would be much less powerful. In particular, I think what is an interesting question is the extent to which the obstacles to the demystification of gender relations, for example, would change under conditions in which you had a democratic egalitarian organization of political economic relations. I think they would. That is, I don't think that there'd be an instant disappearance of gender, and that the ideological and belief systems that correspond to the immediate lived experience somehow just vanish. But I think that the kind of mobilized obstacles to the transformation of gender relations, and what I would think of as the degendering of relations rather than just the transformation of power relations between well-constituted gender, I think the obstacles to that would be reduced. Okay, that's mystification. We have a half hour. Floor is open. And this doesn't have to be just a question and answer, although I'm, of course, always happy to answer whatever questions. Yes, I did turn this on. Good. But this can be open season. You can respond to each other as much as to me. Yeah, Dimitra.
I'm really wondering, referring to this question about this ideology, media, and schools, because millions of people in the United States are kind of taught basic things which kind of break their minds. What can be done to overcome that? I mean, I see in Ukraine kind of students in a few years kind of speak about different things, like they speak about being kind of competitive in the market, and it becomes kind of an intrinsic kind of thing in their minds. Kind of some ideological things are kind of embedded. Some parents they teach their children at home, so they kind of hire private teachers, so that children don't become kind of ideology kind of formatted in school. But is this an option? So they kind of lack social interaction with other students. So what can be done with this problem of ideology formation and certification in schools? It's an open question to everyone. What do you see?
First, in response to your second point about about homeschool kids, I've taught maybe a dozen homeschoolers as a competitive debate coach, and if anything, they are more ideologically charged by far than their counterparts. Public school counterparts, because they are given a much more distilled and particularly tailored set of in the case of, you know, their training in the humanities and literature, et cetera, version of what they ought to know. They, for example, have a particular difficult time grasping that self-interest is not the only method by which people make decisions. Even while they defend a very sort of Christian-oriented notion of charity within their ideology, this doesn't play out. That's just one student's example. Second, I think your first point is that there's an issue with the way that different training is compartmentalized in school as a subject. And I guess I'd ask you to clarify the first bit. Is it that subjects are differentiated and therefore cause a problem?
No, it's called kind of a hidden curriculum. So things which are taught kind of subconsciously. So people don't debate about them. They don't think. They are instilled.
So you're saying they lack critical thinking training?
Right.
Yeah.
So what can be done?
This, small class sizes, and asking kids to not do narrative and do argument from the time they're 10.
But it's on higher education, you see?
That's a problem. It should be done in middle schools.
Yeah.
I actually just read an article like yesterday about this new education technique by this professor of education technology in Newcastle University in the UK named Sugata Mitra. And he is really, what he's been doing experiments about is he gives children in India access to computers. And what he does is he puts a computer in a room with a bunch of students in a kind of a poverty-stricken part of India and just like leaves them alone, like with supervision so that they don't like hurt each other or anything, but like no instruction whatsoever. And basically what the article said is that on this computer, with which they were given like the computer, but they weren't taught how to turn it on, they weren't taught how to do anything with it. And on the computer there's a program that had that kind of taught like a module about DNA replication, and these kids, after a certain amount of time just kind of figuring it out, playing with the computer themselves, they ended up teaching themselves about DNA replication just kind of as a natural curiosity. So there are these kind of cool, innovative teaching techniques that are hard to kind of instill because of all these mandated curriculums and mandated tests and whatnot. But I thought it was really cool how basically it's you know, teaching driven by curiosity and working together with your fellow students rather than being told something by your teacher.
Ellen, Winnie.
I think maybe. It seems like the conversation that we're having right now, or how do we reconcile ideological content with ideological forms? So for example, Dimitri's question was, we have an issue with the media and schools and the ideological content we espouse, but how do we establish, like what guides do we have to think about the forms that ideology actually travels? And these are both examples of why, forms of democratic education perhaps counter some of the ideological pressures put in information itself. But I'm wondering, I guess my question is, and it's clear to see how, I guess my question is, what are the guides that we have for understanding how ideology form itself can structure ideology? How the form of information rather than just the content of information
right.
carries ideological content.
Yeah, so when we talk about ideological apparatuses, this is the machinery through which particular kinds of ideas get transmitted. Now the machinery has transmitted both the content, but there's also a way in which it does it. There's no reason to believe that the machinery that exists is particularly efficient with respect to those goals. So we have historic examples such as the Soviet Union, which had an enormous apparatus of ideological inculcation and highly repressive of dissent, and yet it was unbelievably inefficient in actually instilling these beliefs in people. So the extent to which by the late 80s, everybody was cynical. Nobody believed the official stuff. Those beliefs had no weight behind them. Now it's true that people's imaginations were crippled by the form of intellectual domination. And thus, when the machinery began to collapse, the elites really knew what was they wanted, but the ability for people to imagine a world other than going from the fantasy of communist utopia to the fantasy of capitalist utopia. You know, they lacked the categories of critical thinking to really launch any independent kind of project. You know, sometimes it's said that the Russian people have had the misfortune to suffer from two utopian fantasies in one century. You know, the fantasy of communism and the fantasy of neoliberalism, 70 years apart. I think it's fortunate that ideological apparatuses are actually not as effective as they like to pretend in getting people to believe particular things. Otherwise, if it was as effective as people think, we wouldn't have classes like this because nobody would ever come to them. You know, even if oddball professors offered them, nobody would think it was worth the trouble. Ideologies are more fragile, I think, than people think. And that's because our lived experiences are filled with contradictions and disjunctures. It's not that everything fits together in some nice thing. So there are people who have very rigid, well-worked-out gestalts in which everything fits together and they are completely impervious to any counter-evidence. But that's actually, that level of true believer of in support of an existing system, that's actually a relatively small proportion of all belief systems. Most people's beliefs are pretty chaotic. That means that there's lots of points of entry for transformation if people can be exposed to alternative interpretations and listen to them. You know, so that's why the apparatuses problem becomes important. So in answer to the question, well, what can you do about it? Well, I think it's struggle over the nature of education and over the practices and space in which teachers can act in progressive and more democratic ways. And sometimes those kinds of struggles have some space to operate, sometimes they don't. The idea of building alternative schools then, as that's one response. So there are, in the United States today, as you all know, there's this new development of what are called charter schools. New in the sense that in the last quarter century, I suppose, I don't know when the first ones were founded, but basically new, which is publicly funded, fully publicly funded schools, but which are independent of the normal apparatus of educational control. So, and some of those are progressive teachers and parents who want to create a much more open curriculum of critical understanding where the issue of creating critical capacities rather than indoctrinating with counter-ideologies. So it's not that you want to go from the existing ideology in which you're then going to drum into the heads of kids an alternative ideology. No, you want to create critical capacity. There are such charter schools. It's a very ambiguous idea, though, that as an institutional response, precisely because given the ideological and political configuration in the United States, most charter schools are going to act in ways that are not developing critical consciousness. And especially when you allow for-profit actors to start running charter schools, it corrupts the publicness of the public education even further. But I'm not as opposed to charter schools as a lot of people. I am very wary of them. The idea of charter schools as a way of fracturing an existing system that has monolithic control structures and which is so restrictive, the idea of charter schools as creating spaces for more autonomy. So charter schools that work with unions that are in which teachers are collectively organized as opposed to marginalized, I think have potential. It's just that's a small piece of the charter school movement. And it's the general fallout of this part of our argument is once you realize that mystification is an issue, and you think that one of the things that stabilizes ideologies, dominant ideologies, is the obstacles to demystification. And that the obstacles to demystification are built into the way ideological apparatuses function, then it makes it clear that the if you want to struggle against demystification, you ultimately do have to struggle over the nature of these apparatuses, to open them up, to make them more freewheeling, to make them more internally contradictory, so that there's more space for the development of demystifying practices. And exactly how you do that and in what contexts is a, you know, that's not a simple matter. So there are real utopia proposals around these kinds of issues. Bob McChesney, who's a media analyst, quite famous, with John Nichols, who's a local journalist in Madison, they have a number of proposals which, if implemented, would dramatically expand the space for critical anti-system media in the United States in a way that wouldn't be just marginal niches in the internet. So there are proposals for how you might go about that. Did you have your hand up?
Am I thinking something wrong? Like, it seems to me like everything, like, you know, the house you live in, the place you work, all these things, right, they all influence your ideological development, right? Because if you live in a house, I mean, if you live with a bunch of roommates and you don't get along and blah, 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 that's going to make you think certain ways. But if you live with a bunch of roommates and you, like, create a system to, like, share work or something, you can have, like, different things. And even if it's not conscious that you're, like, getting out of it, like, that seems to, form your ideology in a certain way. And then, likewise, at work, you know, if your boss is, like, really oppressive, or if you don't have a boss, like, these are all different. Is it like, the case that everything, pretty much, every social relationship is, like, too often your ideology, but, like, certain ones, like, schools are obviously more important or even more explicit about it? I mean,
so I think the way to think about this is that just to step back one step, ideology is the process by which lived experience is turned into beliefs that you hold, that become part of your understanding of the world, your cognitive structure. So every setting has lived experience. You learn things from everything. But lived experience is not internalized as raw data. It's always interpreted. So you are always already a interpreter of experience. It's never that you have uninterpreted experience, which is internalized and then interpreted. It's experienced through interpretation. So you are already a fully formed social subject with cognitive categories, with sets of beliefs, and that's what enables you to have a crappy roommate and interpret it in a particular way. Now, some things that happen in your life don't fit with your existing categories and beliefs. And some people are good at just ignoring that. You know, they've got filter mechanisms and screening, bracketing processes in which when things happen that violate their internal belief system, rather than simply interpret it through their old beliefs or question those beliefs, they just ignore it. You know, they silence all these experiences that don't jive. But other people, and this is, I think, what it means to have your cognitive capacities cultivated in a more critical and reflective way, or reflexive way, if you like the Greek rather than the Latin version. I think that's all. The X, as I said, is just signals you're more sophisticated because you go back to Greek roots rather than Latin. You know, so that you're constantly thinking about the experiences. You're having this kind of more self-conscious understanding of what's happening around you. That's what critical consciousness is a lot of. It's a good part of it, at any rate. That means that you become aware of when your beliefs about how things work are in tension with things that you're experiencing, and it leads you then to try to reconstruct your beliefs in one way or another. And it's cumulative. You can get reservoirs of these discordant beliefs, but then it still can often depend, because, you know, this requires creative leaps to change your beliefs. It often still requires exposure to organized, systematic thinking on some topic before, aha, now I understand that. You know, the notion that an epiphany of new beliefs comes from an entirely interior dialogue, well, maybe it happens sometimes, but mostly it happens through intersubjective dialogue, through talking to other people or talking to books. You know, a book is another person, just one step removed, where new sets of ideas as a way of organizing your lived experience. So what often, you know, I think in terms of trying to understand how do people change their beliefs and ideologies? How does demystification in terms of one's own consciousness work? What often will happen is that you'll have an accumulation of lived experiences and a set of existing beliefs, and the things just aren't, you're not comfortable with them, but you don't have a way of reinterpreting what's happened. And then you read something, it can happen as simple as that, which you're reading with a lot of attention. It's mindful reading, you're not just looking at the words. And it enables you to reinterpret all sorts of things that you suddenly realize you've been putting them in the wrong category. And that can really lead to very rapid change in how, you know, and how people think about it. I think that's what the women's movement did in the 70s. It produced very rapid changes in people's self-understanding of a whole set of experiences that they had classified in their own subjectivity in one way over a long period. And then it suddenly gets reclassified. So what sometimes might be called identity change is the kind of wholesale reclassification of a set of experiences which got incorporated into low self-esteem, or I'm not really capable of doing certain things, I'm not the kind of person that would stand up and speak at a meeting. You know, all these sort, because I'm a woman, or because I'm a minority, or because of whatever. And then a whole reclassification can occur, which then can lead to a very rapid change in these sorts of things. Yeah?
So you explain how ideological structures can block demystification, and that one way that we can...
Ideological apparatuses
can block demystification. And one way we can combat that is by sort of struggling with the ideological apparatuses themselves. And then you also explain how building functional alternatives also works to demystify.
Right.
And then earlier in the semester, I remember you mentioning that you don't give primacy to the idea of the labor theory of value, but it also seems as though market fetishism is a pretty important mystification problem under capitalism,
right?
And the labor theory of value works to dismantle the idea of market fetishism in a lot of ways. And so maybe could you give more examples of why you think that the labor theory of value shouldn't be seen as primary?
Because it's the problem with the labor theory of value is that as a scientific account, it's flawed. And so to use it as a way of demystifying the market, the only demystifying way to use it is to say, this is not a scientifically adequate way of understanding value, but it has this nice symbolic, you know, it just, you can't do it with honesty. I can't. I mean, I can't say, because I don't think the labor theory of value is, quote, true. I don't think it's the case that all value is created by labor. It's just not true in the world. Value is created by the deployment of all sorts of scarce resources, of which labor is one. And so since I don't believe in the labor theory of value as a scientifically adequate account of value, I can't use it as a tool for demystifying without mystifying in a different way. I also don't think, though, that market fetishism requires the labor theory of value. Markets are not actors. They're structures of rules, and the rules are created and enforced by people who have created those rules because they advantage certain kinds of actors over others. So when we observe a financial market that goes haywire, it's not because the market has made choices. It's because powerful actors have led to the deregulation of financial markets so as to make more money through those markets. because it's in their interests to do so. And they did so in a way which they didn't intend, it had unintended consequences, of creating more uncontrollable risk in the system as a whole, so it destabilized. And the way to demystify the market is to just attack directly the arguments about the naturalness of the market. You know, that's how I would argue for it. And that the labor theory of value just isn't a good theory of value from a scientific point of view.
So is this basically the argument that, like, there can be a whole bunch of other different commodities that can be used to adequately explain the labor theory of value? Like, there can be a corn theory of value and whatnot. Is that sort of the basis for that, then? Or is it something different?
The fundamental issue around the labor theory of value, then, from a scientific point of view, is a theory of value says that things have value, which explains their relative rates of exchange, that they have this intrinsic property that's embodied in them. And how should we think about it? And what makes something valuable is all of the scarce resources that were deployed to produce that thing as opposed to something else. So it's a cost of production view. There are real costs of producing one thing versus another, real costs. And what makes a cost real is that you've allocated a resource to that thing rather than to something else. So to use economistic language, it's the opportunity costs of using things one way or another. But that's not just labor. It's just all the things. So a corn theory of value would be just as flawed as a labor theory of value, because it's not just corn that you're allocating. You're allocating all the scarce resources that could be used in other ways, and the package of those scarce resources are what we call the value, what makes something valuable.
So I agree with that, but then I also still think that there's a value to the labor theory of value in that labor is the only commodity which workers sell on the market, and so in that way the labor theory of value has, labor is in some ways, can be primary to the idea because it's the only thing that workers actually sell.
Right, but that's a moral justification for why we care about the exploitation of labor values but not the exploitation of iron values or peanut values. We don't care about those because they have no moral significance. If all, you know, if the total peanut value of commodities were used to simply produce peanuts, then you would not be able to produce anything else, well, et cetera. No, we care about the exploitation of labor, not the exploitation of peanuts. Therefore, there's moral warrant for that. But that doesn't make it explanatory. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make it explanatory of the rate of profit. It doesn't make it explanatory of crisis or anything else. And it doesn't, therefore, really provide us with a scientific basis for defetishizing commodities in the market. It does still have a function, still an intellectual use, as a way of pointing to the moral thing we care about, the exploitation of labor. And that's why I still use exploitation as the centerpiece of my account of class, as the nature of the antagonistic relations. And I tend to talk about it as the appropriation of effort, you know, and of the living activity of people. And I don't express it so much in the labor theory of value because of the other ways in which the labor theory of value is misleading. Okay?
Yep.
Yeah?
So it seems that in struggles to build an ideological apparatus that is at least somewhat counter-hegemonic or helps to demystify reality, that there's really hard questions and dilemmas that come up regarding freedom of expression. Could we argue that freedom of expression is not of value in itself, and that we could justify censorship in the name of social justice or whatnot? Or should projects for social transformation allow for media, like for example in the Venezuela case, where there's still the elite media presenting these mystifying
arguments at the same time that they're trying to build another logic, or in Cuba where they prohibit it, like what's like what do you do, you know?
So I think freedom of expression is an intrinsic value because individual autonomy is a value. So freedom of expression is an individual is absolutely a value. The question is, if you have powerful actors who have resources to dominate certain kinds of media, does freedom of expression imply freedom to use your money however you want within the media? Well, that's a very difficult question. It's not a simple question. The problem with empowering censorship as a solution to that difficulty is that it's the historic record, shall we say, of the use of censorship as a device for disciplining the use of power in the media. The historic record is absolutely dismal in being able to restrain the use of that censoring power merely to create an equal playing field for all ideas, as opposed to exclude the ideas you don't like. I'm not saying that that implies that there are no circumstances in which some kind of control over the media. So, you know, I think the media should be public media. I think it's perfectly reasonable. The McChesney kind of proposal is one that would make it way more difficult for rich people to dominate the media. They would still be able to disproportionately affect the media, but they would not be able to dominate the media in the way they do in a media system in which access to the media is determined by the resources you can bring to bear. You know, so I prefer solutions to that problem which focus on empowering everybody and democratic groups and popular movements to have full access to the media rather than blocking the access of views and actors that you dislike, just because the historic record of any blocking strategy has always been so bad.
So like a redistribution, like there's proposals for example on some things, like redistribute the airwaves. So like whatever percentage needs to be for community organizations, whatever percentage could be for private. Like is that?
Well, it's, so I mean that would be one form. The problem, as we know from the internet, is that you can, one of the things you don't want, an undesirable media environment for demystification is one in which everybody can find their niche where they only hear what they like to hear. So you can get a balkanization of the ideological world in which nobody is ever exposed to anything other than stuff they already agree with. Right, so the internet opens up that possibility of highly tailored media, and there's something undesirable about that as well. We want a public forum where ideas clash and are aired and people listen to each other, not just to themselves. So again, these are extremely hard problems. They're and very hard to figure out an institutional design that solves all of the aspects of this problem. The McChesney kind of proposal, at least the version of it, my slight massaging of it, is the following. That when people submit their taxes, they have a $200 annual media voucher. So it's the same per person. Everybody has $200, which they can allocate to media. News, it's for news media, so information media, not for entertainment media. They can allocate it to media that satisfy the following conditions. They have to be non-commercial, so you can't give this money to a for-profit media outlet. And I like to add that they are cooperatively owned and run, so that it's basically for journalist cooperatives of journalists and writers who organize newspapers and broadcasts. They can be the recipients of this $200 per person tax credit. any organization that gets any of these 200s can't get money from anybody else. So the idea is you can't have some rich donor behind the scenes who bankrolls this thing, and then you get all this additional $200. No, it's subscription only, $200, and if you get that, that's the only, you can't get other private sources of funding. Well, there's ways you might want to modify that because you may need startup funds in order to become credible enough to, so, you know, there's all sorts of details. Well, that would seem to me would be a way of promoting high quality news and journalism at both the local and other levels. You would then get kind of cooperatives of cooperatives. You'd get groups of these journalistic cooperatives that would form higher level cooperatives to produce media at other levels. And that would create a much bigger space for a popular democratic kind of media system. It doesn't solve the balkanization problem. You could still have the Christian right-wing media and the lefty hippie media, you know, who knows. But it would provide at least greater underwriting of news production of the sort that's been marginalized under the present system. Okay, we're over time. Next week, so for the essay by Chantal Mouffe, M-O-U-F-F-E, for the discussion of hegemony, ideological hegemony, that essay, it would be good to read ahead of time because it's a difficult, it's not impenetrable, you know, it's not obscure, but it's an excellent piece of writing, really interesting, and that's the piece that I'm going to be most organizing my discussion of the idea of ideological hegemony next time.